You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 423. You cannot always control what goes on outside, but you can always control what goes on inside. Wayne Dyer.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Today's show is also sponsored by the Film Distribution Blueprint. If you want to avoid being taken advantage of by predatory film distributors, this is the course for you. If you want to check it out, head over to indiefilmhustle.com/letmein. Now, guys, today on the show, we have filmmaker, producer, screenwriter, and fellow podcaster, Giles Alderson. And Giles is the host of the Filmmakers Podcast, a very popular podcast over in the UK. Now, I've had the pleasure of being on his show multiple times, and we were talking the other day about his first film. And when he told me that his first film had $1 million budget, I was like, you mean your debut feature film was $1 million? How the hell did that happen? He goes, it's a hell of a story. So he started telling me the story. I'm like, dude, you've got to come on the show and we got to talk about this. So that's what we did. And it is a hell of a tale that he weaves in regards to how he got this movie made, his just the adventures, the misadventures, everything that went on making his film. And what he's doing now, his new projects, how that film led to his next project, and so on and so forth. And Giles is just an awesome, awesome guy, and I am proud to call him my friend. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Giles Alderson. I'd like to welcome to the show Giles Alderson. How are you doing, my friend?
I am good, thank you, Alex. It's an absolute delight, honestly, to be here with you. Honestly.
Yeah, thank you for coming on the show, man. You know, We've known each other for a little while now. You have an amazing podcast called The Filmmakers Podcast, which I've been blessed and honored to be on as a guest as well.
Twice.
Yes, I'm a two-timer. Yes, I'm a two-timer. And we also worked together a little bit on your documentary, which we'll talk about later as well. But before we get going, man, how did you get into the business?
You see, it's a really interesting one for me because obviously the quicker version of it is I was an actor for years. But getting to be an actor was a careers advisor in school. And she said to me, because I was like, I'm going to be a footballer, a soccer player. This is all I'm going to do. I'm going to play for England. I was a goalkeeper. And she said to me, she said, yeah. Well, while you're waiting for that to happen, I saw you in the school play and I heard you, you know, a course at college. While you wait for the football. And I went to this performing arts college and I fell in love with the people, the girls, the idea of it. And I wasn't getting any of the roles, but I wanted it. And I got the bug and I fell in love, and football didn't happen for me, sadly. I'm still waiting. It might, you know, you never know one day. And then I got into acting. And from there, I'd put on plays at the Royal Court in London and the Soho Theatre, which I'd written, and I'd sometimes direct them. And it was just an absolute joy to sort of be involved and behind the scenes. But I wanted to be an actor, not a filmmaker. People kept saying you should really direct shorts, you go do something like that. And I shied away from it for so long. And luckily, I managed to be in some great films. I Want Candy and The Damned United and loads of TV. And The Damned United was a football movie, a soccer movie. So I got to fulfill my two dreams of being a professional footballer, but actually acting away. And then we wrote a pilot for the BBC. The BBC were interested in this pilot that our team at the time were writing. And they said, go off and shoot a pilot. And we said, OK, all right, great. We can do that. And the director pulled out almost last minute. So I went, I'm going to do it. I am going to do this. And I fell in love with directing on the spot. I went, this is amazing. I didn't know what it was. It was just the delight of being on set and actually calling the shots and being in control.
Oh, it's addictive. You say to it's addictive.
The camera guy, you know, so actually, I just like to move this shot around here and come, and they do it. And you're like, what? You're actually doing what I'm saying? Does this make sense? And yeah, choosing the colors and the palette and the costumes. And I then spent the next part of 10 years trying to be a director, and it was very difficult being the actor because people were very much like, you're an actor, mate, you know. And it was very hard to be taken seriously as a director. So whenever I went for directing gigs, I just didn't talk about the acting, and I started to make music videos and promos and brand media and films for banks and whatever I could get my hands on to learn about filmmaking. And yeah, that's pretty much how I got into it.
Very cool. Now, your first film is very interesting, your debut film. It's not the standard fare for so can you tell the story about what was the story behind your debut film, sir?
So, to get to my debut film, it took a long time, and during that time I got burnt so much by predatory producers, by my lack of understanding about what a director/producer/screenwriter should do and be. And I was forever in people's heads, and I didn't feel I belonged, and constantly relying on other people to make those decisions. I was always hearing things third party. You know, someone else would have a meeting and it'd get passed down, and oh, it's not working out, or there'd always be an issue. You know, we had Jason Statham attached to one project at one time. We had Fox attached to another project. And every single time, I wasn't the person speaking to the person, if you like. There was always two or three people in between. And it wound me up so much that I'd hear this third hand. And by then it had been diluted and diluted and diluted. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't take it anymore. During that whole process, I got ripped off, and those projects got taken away from me, and I didn't have any control. So what I decided to do was take back control. I decided to write my own projects fully. I decided to produce my own projects, and I decided to say, I am directing this and no one's going to take it away from me this time. And I learned massively about doing that, about being strong and about being vibrant, and about actually, when you do that, people take you seriously. If you're there going, I'm directing this, if you're not going to put the money in because I'm directing it, or if you're not going to be in it because I'm directing it, then you're not going to be in it. I'm not doing it with you. Whereas in the past, I was so scared. That I think it is an interesting story. There was one project we were doing where I'd found the investor, I'd found the script, I'd found the actors, and there were some big actors. I'd got it all going. It was great. And then suddenly I get a call from one of the investors, one of them saying, oh, there's a bit of a situation. I'm like, what do you mean? He said, speak to the producer. The producer was now not returning calls. It seemed to be that the writer and producer had gone behind my back and put the option in a different name, and then brought my investors to them. And the investor then rang back up, and the investor said, what are you doing? Why dare you do this? And he said, don't worry, we'll give you an associate producer credit. It'd be really good for your career.
Oh, my God.
So I fought. So this is the time where I changed, and I fought back, and I said, I'm not having this anymore. I said I'll take it to court. I'm going to take this further. I'm not having this. Agents were being really dickheads. And I just fought back. I said, I've had enough. And I fought back. And it changed. The film didn't happen, which is sad in some ways. But also, do you know what? I stuck up for myself. And all filmmakers need to do that. Mm-hmm. You've just spout about this all the time. And it's so true. It's your project. And if you want to go make a film, you have to be strong. And I don't mean be a dick. And I don't mean be obtrusive and in the way. You've just got to be strong and powerful and passionate about your project that people want to work with you. And that's kind of how my first project, The Dare, came about. So I'm now in this place where I'm struggling to get a project made. I'm struggling for people to take me seriously. And I went to see a friend's film called Amit Gupta, and he'd made some big movies with some big people. And he just made this $100,000 romantic comedy. And I said to him afterwards, I said, mate, that was fantastic. But why have you gone from making these £2-3 million studio movies, even bigger in some cases, with big names, to making this with no names and no money? He went, because I'm in control and I got to make a movie how I wanted to make a movie. And he turned to me and said, why are you not making a movie? And I said, oh, because. And he went, go home tonight, find a project and go make it for whatever budget you can go make it for. And then you'll be taken seriously. And I took him at his word. And that night I went home, found a script that I was so passionate about. And I went out and I said, right, I'm going to make this movie. During that time, obviously, bits and pieces happened. And I said, I'm also going to write something myself. But that writer of that other project, I brought him on to my project, which was called The Dare. And it was two ideas I'd had sat in a notebook on my desk here. And at one point I was reading through ideas and I just went, why don't I stick them together? There's four people in a basement and we don't know why they're there. And then above, there's an old man and he's got a kid and we don't know their relationship, but it's not his kid. And I thought, why don't I tie these stories together? Why don't they connect somehow? And that was it. It was like a light bulb went off in my head. Now I have this story. And within literally a week, I'd written the whole treatment out, almost 70 pages of this treatment. And I went to my another producer at the time and things happened and fell down. And then I went back to this writer and I said, do you want to write this with me? And within a month, we had a really great first draft. And the story carries on from there and it gets better.
So what's the next step after that? So, because I know, you got this movie made. Yeah. But how you got it made is not usual with the first time director.
No, it's quote unquote. It's really not. Yeah. Quote unquote, first time director. And this is interesting. So I'm now got The Dare. It's a script ready. There's interest. There's proper interest now from new producers and people are very excited. It's a commercial prospect. It's a very Saw-esque gore film, but with much more psychological led themes. And people are going, well, we could make money here. This is great. But no one was actually putting their hand in their pocket. And my good friend Julian Kostoff, who we acted together in a really bad advert years ago for Panasonic, he said, well, listen, I'm producing now. I've made loads of stuff in Bulgaria, bits I've acted and stuff. Can I send this script to the studio in Bulgaria? And I said, yeah, of course, whatever, thinking nothing of it. And literally, I think a couple of weeks later, we got report back from the script readers over in New Boyana Studios. And I'll tell you more about them in a second. But they came back with a really great review saying, yeah, we could shoot this here. Does the filmmaker want to do it here? Get in touch. So Julian said, this is amazing. Look what we've got here. This is great. So we got in touch with the studio and there at New Boyana, and they said, listen, we love this, but we're not going to make this now. So come back in a year, go try and make it. Then we'll make it with you. We potentially, all that. We said, all right, fine. We knew that they were connected to Millennium Media, who do amazing films or action, big action films like Hellboy, London Has Fallen, Rambo recently. We thought, wow, this could be a really great in. Should we wait a year? Because now we've got this other producer here in the UK who's saying, I can give you 150 grand. We can go make this. But I just didn't believe him. You know, when you thought.
Shocking, like, shocking.
Shocking, shocking.
I mean, so shocking. Shocking, Josh. Shocking.
And there was something about him that was just not right. There was just something. But I was like, but I want to make a movie. I need to make a movie. I'm desperate now by this point. For those filmmakers out there who know what I was going through, who was going through that, you're desperate to make a film. And it was my baby and I could do this. And suddenly this guy's offering some sort of money to go make it. So we went through another month of pre-production and we were about to sign the deal and go through this. And to be honest, it could have been an absolute shit show of I did. You know, when you just think, is this real? Is it not? Is the money really going to turn up? Is it really going to be 60 grand? Is people going to run away with this money that he's saying he's got? And it all seemed really dodgy. There's some dodgy people involved. And
shocking. So the money is going to drop any day now. That's the word.
Drop every day. But we would. Very far advanced with pre-production and looking at locations and all this and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So Julian went, look, I'm going to go back to the studio again and just knock on that door one more time and tell them we've got money. This is your last chance to make this movie. Do you want to do it? And he calls me back after he called him and he said, you'll never guess what. I said, what? He said, if you fly over tomorrow, they're going to see you. And I went, what? He said, you fly to Bulgaria tomorrow, and this is like 5 p.m. at night, they will see you. And I'm like, oh, my God, I drop everything. I look at flights. I go, oh, God, that's way too expensive for my price range. But, okay, you've got to do this. This is an opportunity to go to a major studio.
Well, it's an adventure. It's an adventure.
It's an adventure for one thing. Fly to Bulgaria. Let's do this. So I practiced my pitch. I said, let's do it. Let's do it. Let's book the flight. They said they'd pay for the hotel. I said, great. I'll stay for the night. They said, I spoke to them. I said, yeah, if you come over, here's the flight details. Here's your hotel details now. We will show you around the studio. So I booked the flight on the time that they'd suggested. Done. I'm sitting on this flight on my own, absolutely cacking myself. I don't know what to expect. This is crazy. I'm like, oh, my God, I'm actually going to a film studio to pitch my movie. Is this real? They like it. We know they like it. I get to the hotel and they say, okay, Yarev is the exec who's running the show. He says he's a bit busy right now, so just chill here for a bit. I said, okay. I'm now in Bulgaria in some hotel. I can't go out. I've got no money. I can't afford to literally eat. I'm like, oh, my God, how am I going to do this? And eventually he shows up, and he's this wonderful, charismatic, interesting guy. And he's just like, hey, really laid back, almost like in flip-flops and a t-shirt. And I'm like, really? This guy runs this studio? Okay, cool. All right. Fair hair, tall as well, like a bear. I'm like, wow. Okay. And he says, so tell me about your movie. And I went, okay, well, you've seen the pitch. What do I need to tell you? He went, nah, I know nothing. And I went, deep breath, go for it. And this is huge advice I can give to any filmmakers, is know your pitch inside out. Be fully prepared to bullshit if you have to, but know it so well that it's like you're telling your mates down the pub. Know it so well that it's exciting, it's enticing, that they really think, okay, this guy knows what he's doing, because they're investing in you. And this is a secret I've only learned recently. I got my movie made because of how I pitched it and how I talked about this movie and how I was passionate about it. Because if I'd come across all, I don't know. I'm kind of excited to make the, would done. They have gone with me?
Done.
I'm done. I'm out the door. So I had to pretend to be, I pretend, and I mean pretend because you are absolutely kecking yourself, to know what you're talking about. I've not made a movie. I'm now, I made a studio, and they're going, well, why should I invest in you? Why should I put our hard-earned money into you? So I gave my best pitch. I did as strong as I could, and I sold myself to high heaven. He said, great, thank you. I like your idea. I like you. I need to think about this. And I said, okay, but you know, we've got a UK producer ready to go. We're about to sign the deal. Bullshit. But yeah, it's kind of true, but you know, not. And he said, yeah, but I need time to think about it. So if you want to take that deal, take it. I'm like, oh,
yeah, you don't play. You can't be playing hardball.
The wrong game.
Real quick, I want to stop you there for a second. So everyone listening, there's a moment to play hardball, or not even hardball, but to play that game of like, well, you know, there's another couple on the lot that wants to buy this car. And if you don't buy it now, by the next 20 minutes, it's going to have to go. That only works if the person that you're selling to really wants and has no other options. Like, they're in love with your project or your car, for the analogy's sake. Because he was like a studio head, he had never even heard about it. At least that's what he said, and wanted to hear all of that. That's not the play. And you could have very easily screwed up at that moment. It could have been, he could have said, you know what? Why don't you just go off and do that? Thanks, bye. Mm-hmm. It just luck. Is that fair?
Totally fair. Totally fair. And luck was on my side that I came prepared, as in not only was I very good with the pitch and passionate, but I also came with a ton of photos, a ton of moods, a ton of images, even a reel, nice. A rip reel. I came with what you'd come as if you were making the movie tomorrow. Color nice. Palettes, costume ideas, casting ideas. Even at that point, we'd pretty much cast the movie. Everything I could think of. From listening to your amazing podcast, from listening to people and books that I've read about how to go in and pitch yourself, and just being clever about it and thinking. And my main tip there as well would be, I didn't just talk about the movie. And this is interesting and a really fine line, because it's just me and him in a hotel. You know, we hadn't gone to the studio. He'd come to the hotel and he said, we're sitting in this echoey chamber of this really weird Eastern European gold light hotel that I was put in. And it's just me and him. So I also went onto his level. I also talked to him as a person. I tried to see if he was interested in soccer. No, he wasn't. I tried to see if he was interested. Whatever he was interested in, we talked about. But I got him to like me. I got him to be interested in me as a person, because he had no idea if I could make a movie. He had no idea if my film was any good or if I could actually shoot anything. He was interested in me. And what cleverly he did was he kept passing the buck back to me and asking about me and what I did and how I, anything to not talk about the film, if you like. So I'm like, oh, have I done enough? Have I done enough? So he says, okay, well, you've got the other film, you've got the other producers, but you choose what you want to do. But I'm coming to London in a month. I'm going to bring my other producer with me. If you're still interested, we're going to pitch again then. I said, absolutely. He said, first of all, though, I'm going to take you around the studio. And I want you to tell me if you think you can shoot your movie in this studio. Now, obviously, I'm thinking,
beautiful. Oh, masterful.
Well, of course. I don't need to see it. Obviously, I'd looked at the photos. I'd looked at the whole place. There's no question about it. When someone says, can you shoot your movie in a studio? Yeah. So, and at that point, I'm going, well, great. Yeah, it'd be really good to look at some of the locations and the ideas. Yeah, great. Take me around. I walk into this studio. New Bayana Studios is gorgeous. It's basically, they've got a New York set, New York Street. It looks like New York. They've got London Street. They've got a gulag. They've got forests. They've got everything you can imagine. And 16 studio spaces. Gorgeous. So obviously, I walk around like a kid in a candy shop going, oh my God, look at this place. Proper tour with the proper people who run the studio. Yariv's gone off now doing something else. And eventually I go back because I'm waiting for my flight, and they just sit me in an office for a while. And then he eventually comes back and he says, so, could you shoot your movie here? And I look at him very seriously and look him in the eyes and I say, no.
Absolutely. This is a cesspool.
This is absolutely cesspool. It's horrible. And we have a laugh about it. And I say, of course I can. I've got plans. I know how we could do the forest. You know, the usual. He says, great. Fantastic. Lovely to meet you. I've got to go. Good luck with your flight back. I'm coming to London in a month. Excellent. I go back. I'm like, what are we going to do to Julian? He's like, well, of course, we've got to wait now. We've got to wait. So we're sort of fobbing the other producer off a bit. And I don't mean that in a nasty way. He was also all over the place. So it worked out well. A month later, he comes back to London, and he sits down with his line producer, and the same thing happened again. We hardly talked about the movie at all. I had to pitch it as if I'd never pitched it before. I had to describe it as I've never had before. We talked about everything and anything as well, apart from the film. And he got to know me. He got to know Julian really well, and his other producer was brilliant, and we got on brilliantly. And again, I still believe this. The real reason I got that film made was because he liked me. It didn't really matter about the film. Of course it did. Of course it was important. But what was important was me and the fact that he felt, I've got to work with this kid for 2, 3, and actually, as it's turned out, 4 years before the film's got released in the UK. And we'll come to that, if you like, of why it took so long. And there we are. And suddenly now, after that meeting, he goes, great. Okay, well, we'd like to do the movie. And I'm literally burning up inside, and my heart is racing, and I'm trying to keep it cool. Mm-hmm. And I go, okay, good, all right, yeah. Well, I think we could do it. He said, well, how are you going to deal with the other producer? And I went, I think we'll be all right. I think we'll be able to do with this.
We're going
to
make that work. We'll make that work on our end. We'll make it work on our end.
We'll make it work. And again, we hadn't signed anything with the other producer, and it wasn't like it was anything. It was, again, it was all pie in the sky and talk, and just another sort of fake investor producer. He's not gone and made any other films, and he's not. So it was another one of those fake things. So sure. I'm so glad it didn't go that way. And then I spent 3 months in Bulgaria prepping the movie in their movie studios, talking about how we're going to make this movie. And
so
it was just incredible. You know, you're literally walking there. Yeah, I had no idea which studio was going to be mine, and they're going to build it. And we're designing how we're going to build the basement and build the farmhouse. And it was just a magical
time. And this is your first film.
And this is my debut movie, and it's with, you know, Millennium Media, and it's with B2Y, and it's a studio in Ljubljana. And there I am, this kid who's written something with his pal Johnny Gran, and suddenly now my other pal Julian Kostov is now producing this, if you like, Hollywood movie, and I'm directing it as my debut movie. And I can tell you now, I was shitting myself.
Well, no, I mean, anyone listening here is like, hey. Jesus, like this is, it's the dream, but it's the nightmare all at the same time. I wanted to back up on something in your story where you kept saying that like they talked about everything except the movie.
Yes.
And the reason, and the reason I want the audience to understand, the reason why they do that is because they already know the project is something they're interested in or of quality. That's not the, because they have 20 of those. On the on the desk, at it's like, you know, this is not Avatar.
Not, I mean, yeah,
this is they have 20 other projects who are of equal or better quality or markability or money making potential. It's all there, but the X factor is always the filmmaker. It's always you. And I've been in those meetings as well where they're just feeling you out, because I'm going to have to go down the road with this guy or this girl for the next year to two, if not longer. Can I work with this person? And regardless if it's the best script in the world, if you're a dick, it is done. It's over. And that's why they kind of played that game, because they were, you could tell that that's a seasoned producer. That's a seasoned filmmaker who walked you through those paces. And like, and then made you wait a month on top of that, because he could have easily greenlit it while you were there.
Of course.
He could have just said, yeah, we want to do it. What do we want to do? No, he let you wait for a month. Let's see how this all plays out. This is all a game. And this is something that is completely unwritten in the game playbook.
In the game manual of making films. It's just unwritten that. And I think it's vital. It's so important that filmmakers understand that it is them. They are the ones that get films made. They are the ones. I produce movies now, you know. It's my journey of that. Since that time, has I've produced movies, and I'm working with people I want to work with. If for one, you know this as well as I, making a film is one of the hardest things you might do. It's torturous. It's hard work. If you're in the trenches with someone who's a bit of a dick, not even a massive dick, a bit of a dick, you're going, I can't be bothered. I've got other things. I'd rather make my own project, and God forbid me be a dick on that. Do you know what I mean? It's like...
So, also, yeah, as you get older, you just start your tolerance for that. Like when you're 20 something, your tolerance for that is very high. Like things I did at my 20s, I look back now, I'm like, oh my God, I would never. But when you're young and hungry, you deal with a lot of stuff that you would not deal with as you get older. But it's
so true.
So much like as I even in my post business, I would start. We're talking to potential clients and I'll be just like, we could do this for this much, but let's talk about you. And I would just start feeling them out. And I'm like, oh no, this guy's going to be a nightmare. I would have done it for 20,000, but it's going to be 50. If I got to put up with you, I need to be paid for this pain.
Absolutely right. Absolutely. And interestingly, when I was in that 3 month period, I actually think it might've ended up being longer. We hadn't got a start date, and this was freaking me out because I'm now in Bulgaria, away from my family, in a hotel room, pretty much on my own a lot of the time, getting ferried to the studio, and we didn't have a start date because the next London Has Fallen or movies come in, or Adrian Brody's now shooting, or Antonio Banderas is now shooting, and the studio, oh, it's been pushed. And this freaked me out so much that at one point, sadly, my missus's dad had died, so I was like, okay, I need to fly back, but if I fly back, this could be a real problem and the film might just die because it's me pushing it here. I'm in the studio going, please give me a start date, please, my actors are now going, is this really happening? The agents are knocking on the door and Julian's going, oh God, what are we going to do? So I said, I'm going to fly back, and I'm gone. And I kind of knew at that point, if they don't green light it while I'm gone, this might not happen. And it was a risk. And I remember, I think I was back a week and a half after the funeral, and I called up Yariv and I said, Yariv, this needs to be the start date, and this needs to be when we start the edit because of my cast and because of the edit. Is this possible? Please tell me this is a go. And he said, okay, let's do it. And it was such a weird thing that was the green light. That was the moment. And whether it was me flying back and not being in the vicinity and not knocking on the door all the time and not being a pest, and not that I was doing that at all. I was just in this zone. But It was something about that was really interesting. From that moment, it was all, there's the start date, and then it moved forward. I just wanted to talk about that because I found that really fascinating as a thing. Why did that happen? Why? And the whole time, really, I was thinking I'm a fraud. Any moment now, they're just going to go, Giles, it's not you. Sorry, we made a mistake. No, we opened the wrong door.
Imposter syndrome. It is something. It is a disease that runs rampant through the filmmaking community and screenwriting community. Is that whole like, oh, they're going to figure me out. Look, I still feel that way sometimes. We all do. I've talked to I've interviewed big filmmakers, big screenwriters, and I ask them sometimes, either on the show or off the show, and they go, yeah, I still feel. I'm like, but you won an Oscar. And they're like, yeah, I still kind of feel like, look, was it Henry Fonda? I think it was Henry Fonda. Every time he would go on to do a play, right before he would go on, he'd throw up.
Yeah, absolutely.
At 75.
I think Judi Dench still does that now. We had Christy Wilson-Cairns, the screenwriter of 1917, on the podcast recently. She said the same thing. She had a constant. She's now writing Star Wars. She says, I constantly feel that I'm an imposter. I feel any minute now they're going to go, you can't write. Why are you here? And we feel that too. But because it was my first movie, it was just this really weird, I didn't feel like I'd proved myself in any way, shape or form. And another interesting story with Yariv, another point I was sat down with him, and I'd made all these shorts, award-winning shorts and docs and promos and whatever. And he said, so I'm going to tell you what a first AD does. I'm going to tell you who calls action. And I was like, oh, no, I know. But when you think, oh, if I say I know, is he going to think, well, hang on. But he just kind of explained how a set works. And I thought, hang on,
I know nothing.
I've never been on a movie set before. And it was a really interesting moment that I just looked at Julian. He looked at me and went, shut up, just let him talk. And it was just an amazing moment that you just go, okay.
So cool, let's dissect that for a second. So This man is giving you seven figures sure. to make this film. Yeah. Which is insane. It's insane. I've worked on a project that there was a first-time director that had $1 million, and boy, did that didn't go well. Like really, really badly. So anytime you give a seven-figure deal to a first-time director, you really are rolling the dice. So he basically gave you the shot based on the script and you. Not your experience, not where you came from. And he was like so confident in who you are as a human being that he's like, oh, I could teach you how to direct. I could teach you. You have vision, and we'll get good people around you, and we'll get the movie made. But you're the driving force behind it, but you just need some help technically, and we can help you with that. That is the sign of a very seasoned producer, someone and I've spoken to those guys, and I've met those guys. And when you speak to people at that level, they're just at a completely different, wavelength. Because normally, you and I, when we're coming up, we're dealing with the schmucks, the guys who are like, I got the money, I got this investor over that here, guy. I got that guy, and I've got, how much do you want? $3 million? That's nothing. I spit $3 million. I throw that away in the morning. All that stuff. How much do you need? Like all that kind of stuff. And that's these posers are what most filmmakers deal with, are posers, people who are pretending or they're acting like they're the big shots. But did you notice in your story so far, when you met this guy, he showed up in almost flip-flops and a t-shirt and he ran the studio. Why? Because he wasn't trying to impress anyone. He was so comfortable with who he was. And what he does, that he doesn't need to impress you, but the dude shows up in a $5,000 suit you know, and from my experience dealing with these kind of big producers, they don't do that. No. They don't show off like that. They'll just, they might be dicks, they might be arrogant, they might be other things, but they generally don't show off. And if they do, they're so insecure. It's fascinating. Yeah.
It's fascinating.
But he was very secure.
I got my shot because of that. Absolutely agree. He liked me. He believed in what I could do and my vision. And I constantly was telling him my vision. I was constantly updating. I was doing storyboards for days and days and days. With that. They gave me a storyboard artist, for God's sake. And I was like, okay. They're like, well, how are you going to do it? I was like, So now I've got to think about how to draw it. You know, I knew how to make it look. But to draw it, I'm like, so I used Lego figures. And this is really, I went to the shop nearby and I got a load of Lego figures. Because again, I'm in Bulgaria. Not everyone's great at English, you know, that some people are brilliant, but not everyone. So when you're trying to talk two shot or a specific angle you want, it doesn't really translate. So I've got these little mini Lego figures and I put a dagger in one of their hands and I just kept moving them around this, you know, because most of it's set in a basement. And I just take photos of it. I'd show, okay, I'm going to shoot from this angle. I'll do this. And she'd go, oh, okay, cool. And it made a huge difference to understanding my vision. And yeah, but you're right. He believed in me and based on the script and me. And that is a huge lesson to any filmmaker out there, is that is what it's about. This world is that. Obviously, you've got to be talented and you've got to know what you're doing. And I'm sure he'd done his homework. But
yeah, no. I promise you the whole I don't know anything. That's no. Yeah. I promise you he knew what was going on. He'd probably read the script. He probably listened to the pitch. He just wanted to hear you say it. There's no way a man like that's just going to show up going, So what are you about? Like, he's not going to get in a car, drive to your hotel.
No chance.
No chance at all. But I want to make this very clear to everyone listening. Your story is an anomaly. It is an outlier. It is not the norm. And from someone who's been hustling in the business for 25 years, you're the first positive example of someone having $1 million plus, seven-figure plus film, and in their first film, and not just epically throwing the money away. Your ego gets out of hand. But how old were you when you made this?
It was 4 years ago. It was four years ago we shot.
Yeah, man, you're not a kid.
No, I was definitely not a kid.
Yeah. So it's a little bit different. I promise you, if you would have been 10 years younger, this wouldn't have happened.
I agree. Totally agree.
He wouldn't have given it to you.
He wouldn't have. And I'm glad, because back then when I was trying to make the movies, like say the 8 year period of trying to do that up until that 4 years ago, I wouldn't have been ready. You know, like I say, when I had Jason Statham, when we had Fox, I wasn't ready for that. That's why it didn't happen. As much as it hurt and I cried in my pillow and all these things when it all fell down. And the other thing as well is I only had one project and I'm never doing that again. Have more than one. Have 10. So that if one falls down, it's not the end of the world. Back then I had one. But yeah, it is an anomaly and I'm amazed. And do you know what? I worked so hard when we were shooting and I gave it everything. And do you know what? Fantastically, it's done really well.
So why did it take so long to get out?
So it took so long to get out because it's a studio movie and we needed to do pickups. Basically, the last part of the movie originally was they come out of the cabin, if you like, you know, not to give any spoilers away of the film, but it was snowing on the day we needed to shoot during our principal photography. So we were like, don't worry, we'll come back and shoot in a month's time. When you've had a look at the edit, you can do some other pickups then. He'd already promised me, and this was interesting, he only came to set twice or three times, and both those times he literally almost walked right onto in the middle of where the camera was. He just walked on. And I'm there literally with our young kid who's playing young Dominic. And I could see someone out the corner of my eye. I'm like, why is there someone stood there? I think any minute now I'm going to go, I'm sorry, you can't be there. There's the camera coming through and stuff like that. And I'm directing this kid and I'm really going into detail. And it was a great moment for him to be stood there watching me really direct this kid to try and get the performance. And I look up and there he is, just stood there sort of half smiling at me going, cool. And he pulls me. I'm so glad it was that moment and not maybe another moment where I'd maybe not doing what I'm supposed to do or whatever. And he pulls me aside and he says, look, we're really happy with where it's going. I'm going to give you two extra pickup days. And I went, can I have them now? I said, can I finish? I need them. I'm desperate. We had one bit to shoot that really should take 6 days. And in the end, we got 2 days at night. It was and it shouldn't have been. Anyway, that I can go into that another time. But he pulled me aside and I said, you get an extra 2 days. And I said, can I have them now? And he said, no, you'll need them later. I promise you, when you look at the edit, you'll need them. So anyway, so I knew I had these 2 days. So when the snow fall came, I was like, okay, well, we'll have to pick that up in a month's time or whatever. So I'm now in the edit suite. I'm editing away. And
still in Bulgaria. Still in Bulgaria.
Still in Bulgaria for this point. It was pretty soon after I went back and then edited with my great editor, Ollie Parker, back in the UK. And during that time, there was no sign of any pickup times. There was nothing. And I'm like, when's it happening? They went, oh, finish the edit first and then we'll look at it properly. And a year goes by. And
Oh, my God.
Yeah. We've now finished the edit. I think we had 2 months to do that. So we'd done that. And they said, great, we're now going to look at the screening. And I went over to Bulgaria a month later. And they said, right, screening in front of all our execs and the big people. And they said, gave us notes and said, here's some notes. Here's what we want you to change. And here's some pickups we want you to do. I said, yeah, great. They're all following my style. No problem. I was in a great place. It's like happy. Then they just couldn't find time to us to shoot because the next Jason Statham film came in. The next Fallen film has come in. Hellboy then started shooting. And every time was like, we're going to fit you in. We're just going to. And then when they found a time, my actors weren't available. Now they're all doing really, really well. Or they've now cut their hair. Or all these things had a big impact. So it was a full year later when we shot the first set of pickups. Then we did another edit of the movie and put them in. At that point, Millennium said, we think you should reshoot the beginning because he comes across as a bit of a dicky lead character. It was a stag do. I'd got all my mates across to play the stag do guys. And they went, you're just going to have to cut all that. We want him to be a family man. It's better for the story. And it was. They were 100% right. But, oh, my God, it killed me to cut out this stuff and my friends as well. So there was another delay. Now we have to reshoot that. We now need to wait for my actors and a studio space to shoot that. 2 years go by. Oh, my God.
You're doing other things during this time.
Of course. Now I'd made another feature film during that time. You think, is anything going to come out? You feel really silly. You know, I'd started the filmmaker's podcast at that point, and I'm talking about the dare constantly, and I'm like, is it ever going to come out? Is this ever going to happen? So I think it was, fully maybe 2.5 up to 3 years later before we now locked the final film. And then it was a case of now they're showing it at Cannes. Now we're showing it at these places. We'd already got sales in certain territories already just off the back of my first teaser I'd done 3.5 years ago. So we'd already pre-sold in so many territories off that. And it took that long. You know, that's just how it is. And in that, it came out in March in the US and Canada. And now it's October in the UK. And that's full 4 years after we first started principal photography.
Jesus.
It can go. Like I say, I've had another movie, two movies out in that time. One that we did, it was like 5 month turnaround. This is 4 years, and that's your studio. My debut movie has come out after my second and third movies.
So another lesson we should be talking to everyone listening: patience.
Patience is so key.
Patience.
I was frustrated a lot of that time.
That is what this business does. It will wear you down. Grind you little by, and it's not sometimes it's a big hit, but more likely it's the paper cuts of something like this that could just drive you crazy. Imagine if you had done, you were like working you work in a Starbucks during this time, because for whatever reason, your whole life is wrapped around this. You were smart enough to start working on other projects and get other things developed. A lot of filmmakers I know don't do that. They'll just sit for 4 years.
Same, I know friends who've done the same. They've gone, no, I want this film to come out and be successful, and then I can get a bigger studio movie off the back of that. I totally disagree with that. I think you improve as a director by directing. If you're not directing, you're sat on your bum at home. If an actor is constantly on set, a DP is constantly on set, they're constantly honing their craft and getting better. If you've not directed for 4 years, God forbid, you know, let's say The Dare comes out and it was a washout. It wasn't any good. Now I've wasted 4 years and now no one's going to hire me. But if I've made 2-3 other movies during that time, people are now going, oh, cool. It doesn't matter what happened to that first movie. You've already had other successes or your failures or whatever they are. Why would you wait? the more I've directed, the better I've got.
Well,
fact.
Well, then I'm gonna play devil's advocate, and I completely agree with you. But I'm gonna play devil's advocate. I'm like, but Stanley Kubrick waits 7 years between movies. He doesn't direct all the time. And I would answer, he was Stanley Kubrick.
He's Stanley fucking Kubrick.
He can
do what he wants.
Whatever Stanley wants, and I promise you, because I know someone out there's listening, going, well, you know. Like some of these directors take 3-4 years between movies. You don't have to be directing all the time. I'm like, yeah, those guys have forgotten more about filmmaking than you will ever learn.
Absolutely. And do you know what? Those guys will probably be paid a retainer, or they've been paid to write scripts by studios or on deals, all that. When you're not, when you're an independent filmmaker, what are you waiting for? Go make another movie. Don't worry about it. It doesn't matter. You have to be in control of your career, because this is another secret, and Alex has probably told me this many times, is a lot of these people won't watch your movies. If they're out, they're being released, they know it's come out, they can speak to someone say, yeah, it was cool, that's all they need to know. They might watch the trailer. You think they're going to sit through and watch your movie? Why? They're going to talk to you about the new one you've got, the next one you've got. So it doesn't matter if you've made another 3, 4, 5 movies that maybe aren't as good as that one, or whatever it is. It doesn't matter, you're making films. And you get better. You work better with people. More actors want to work with you because you've made more films. All these type of things. You meet more people. It's vital that you as a filmmaker constantly work that muscle. That's my opinion. I know plenty of friends who don't do it that way. That's their prerogative and their choice. But I love being on set. That's why I produce as well, because you can be on set, right?
Yeah, it's the only thing that cures or at least treats this affliction that we have that's called filmmaking.
Totally.
It's the only thing.
It really is. And just, I suppose, to wrap up the whole Dare thing, as much as it's not come out in the UK yet, it did massive numbers in Holland. Cinema was – I didn't even know it was on in the cinema in Holland. Huge numbers. I have no idea why, how, no publicity. Anyway, the good thing about this is there's big talk of a sequel, and and we're really deep in, you know, developing it. And isn't that magical that some small idea I had in literally my loft here, two ideas, and it becomes something real and tangible that people can love and hate and disagree with and argue about. But hey, you get to be part of this magical world called movie making, and you don't do that by sitting on your ass, and you don't do that by going, one day I'll write a script and one day I'll give it to a producer. No, you've got to do it, and you've got to send it to those producers and find them and go to events. That's how shit happens.
And now during this waiting time, you also made a couple other like micro budget films. Where were so which is the movie that went to Showtime and Sky, and how did you get that to work out?
So this is called A Serial Killer's Guide to Life. And yes, just after I'd finished shooting the first block of principal photography on The Dare, my good friend Stanton Cousins Rowe said, look, I'm making this movie called A Serial Killer's Guide to Life. Would you come and help me produce it? Because they're acting it. He said, you know, there's a few of the producers on and stuff. Come and share the load. And I did, and it was micro budget, but it was a wonderful experience for me at the time, even though I'd produced and directed a load of other stuff, to actually go on someone else's movie and not be creative and do the nuts and bolts of making a film. The literally, how does a truck go from there? Who empties the toilet? Me. All right. How do you know all these type of things actors need to get from there to there? Okay, it's raining. We need to get umbrellas out. We need to put tents up. All this stuff is nuts and bolts of filmmaking, producing, that a lot of people don't realize is producing. So I learned that and I did it. And we had a great shoot, and the film turned out wonderfully and got selected for Fright Fest and got awards across the board, and you know,
How did you get that microfilm to Showtime and to Sky Movies?
Yeah, so it was a case of getting with the right distributor with that case. So we did, we knew it was good, we knew that the buzz was great. We were sending out little teasers, and the buzz was really good on the film. So what we did was we kind of did a bidding war in a cinema in London, in a screening room in London, and we got all the distributors to turn up. And there was some really lovely people came and saw it and gave us some brilliant feedback. And again, this is a movie with no real names in it, certainly not at the time. Now, the sister in Fleabag, Sian Clifford, she's in the movie. But at the time, it wasn't massive. And just some brilliant actors. And we then pitched it to them and pitched it to the whole team of how we'd do this. And we negotiate the deals. And Stan
directly or with a distributor directly. Or directly with Sky?
We directly went with the distributors. Yeah.
Okay.
Directly talked to about how we're going to make this, how we're going to sell this film around the world directly with the distributor. So we did the contract. Stan mainly ran that. And yeah, from that, that's how we got it onto Sky Movies and to Showtime.
And what was your experience with this distributor? I always love to ask, was it a positive? Was it a negative? Did you get paid? Things like that.
Yeah, it was very positive. Arrow Films are very good in the UK and very well known for that. So we specifically targeted distributors who we knew. And I did my research and homework and studied Staten on who the distributors were for this type of film, because it's a quirky Sightseers, Thelma and Louise type movie.
Right, right.
So it had a quirk. It's slightly unusual. It's got horror elements, but it's also, you know, a drama. So we made sure we investigated who these distributors were to make sure that they were right for the movie. And I rang so many friends who'd worked with them and said, did they rip you off? Did this happen? And they said, no. This is how to behave. This is how to do it. So we did that. We really did our homework, and it's paid off massively. And Serial Killer's Guide to Life has done really well.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Really, that's amazing. Yeah. And that was a micro budget.
It was a micro budget. Yeah.
And then you did another movie during this time period on Arthurian Legend, low budget film. Because because why not?
Because why not?
Because why not?
Because why not? And also because when you, like I say, when you're making movies and you're around movies, and I produced another movie in that time, and I made another documentary called World of Darkness, and then the Food for Thought documentary, which you were involved in as well, we were shooting. And then Signature Entertainment, who a friend of mine was working with a lot, said, hey, look, you're in the mix for the making this King Arthur movie because you'd made movies. That was the be all and end. It didn't matter that the day hadn't come out. They could see the trailer. They could see the bits and pieces I'd made for it. And they suddenly were really keen for me to come and direct it. And again, the same thing. I went in and pitched and went in and sold myself as how I could do this. And again, the same thing. They liked me. They liked me. But also, what was really interesting here is I felt much more aware of my own ability, and I know it's a strange one, but I was also very much more secure of myself.
Well, of course, look, man, you've gone down the path. You've already walked the path a little bit. Like, yeah, I mean, before shooting for The Mob and after shooting for The Mob, I was a little bit of a different filmmaker, you know, dealing with that adventure of The Mob and meeting these big movie guys in LA and stuff. Absolutely. You feel sometimes you feel more confident. Some other times you feel like, I can't do this. there's that as well. But no, once you start getting you get a feature under your belt, two features under your belt. That's the thing I always try to tell people. I'm like, you know, everyone talked about Robert Rodriguez and a mariachi, but that was his first film. Like, he did 25 shorts before then. He felt really comfortable with the gear, with the visuals. He edited everything. And that's the thing. You just got to get the practice in. And the same thing with screenwriting. Can't just write one screenplay. Yes. You got to write 20.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, it's not going to happen for you if you do that. Or you would be massively lucky if you do that. You know, like I said before, The Dare, I'd made so many mistakes, so many issues, so many other screenplays that are sat on my shelf now and never get made that aren't good enough. But I had to go through those failures to be good enough or to be anywhere close to good enough that someone would take a chance on you. And someone took a chance on me with Arthur and Merlin. And yeah, that's now out. Mostly around the world, I think in the States in December. But yeah, I got to make an Arthurian movie about King Arthur. I mean, well, how brilliant. I've got to bring on my DP from The Dare. I got to bring in brilliant actors. I got to bring back Richard Brake, who stars in The Dare, and bring him as Merlin, and Richard Shaw. You know, and these people you want to work with and you're passionate about. And I tell you what, if you're good to them, and you treat them well and you understand how an actor works, which is great that I was an actor as well, because I understand what goes through an actor's mind. I do understand when you're covered in blood or you've been screaming all day, how difficult that is, and how when you say, I need another take, they are going to kick off at you and they are going to be angry. So you've got to be aware of that and plan your shoots and your shots correctly because of that. That these people, once you're nice and good to them, they will want to work with you again. And it was so lovely, Richard Brake. Obviously, he's been in Game of Thrones and so many other amazing movies like Mandy and whatnot, 31, and loads of really cool stuff. That he's been saying in interviews now when he's been promoting Arthur and Merlin, he came to do it because of me. He wanted to work with me again. And this is just a really important lesson for filmmakers, is don't be that dick that Alex always says. Don't do it. If there's issues on set, keep them to yourself. Don't be the big I am. This is a team game. Mm-hmm. I learned that. It's this team. Everyone's in it together. From your production assistants all the way up to your execs. Everyone's in this together. And you need to be as careful with them as you are with the money. You know, it's everyone's important. And I'm learning. You've got to learn. But don't be the big, think you're the big bollocks. Absolutely not.
So I have to ask you. So you did the DARE. It started about four. This whole process started about 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so when did you start listening to my podcast? Because I've been doing it for 5 years. So did you were you listening to the podcast while you were making this?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
It's amazing.
It's a huge inspiration. And you were an inspiration for starting my podcast in the UK because I felt there wasn't an Indie Film Hustle type thing in the UK as such that with an English voice. And it was only after I'd done the DARE that I felt even anywhere near able to talk about that sort of stuff. But no, I was a full-on Indie Film Hustle fan.
That's
all
amazing.
The time through that. It inspired me massively. You were one of the people who you constantly banging on about, go make a film, go do it.
Well, yeah, so you saw, you were like listening during when I was making Meg.
Well, you were making Meg, and the episode you did with the full cast for me was an absolute joy. Yeah. So, I mean, all back then. It was a huge inspiration for me, and I imagine lots of other filmmakers out
there. The reason I ask is because there are other filmmakers that I've talked to that were like, yeah, you know, I made my first feature around the time that you were making Meg, and I was listening to you while I was going through my stuff, and I always find it fascinating. It's just like, you know, for this as well as I do, man. Like when you podcast, you just talk into a microphone.
Sure.
You know, and if you interview, if you're lucky enough to do interviews, you get to talk to one other person. You really don't know how this, once you press publish, you really kind of don't know what happens out there in the ether. And I always love hearing stories about, you know, email. I get emails all the time. I'm like this or that, but specific stories about like you, like, oh, I was making this $1 million, you know, plus film.
Yeah.
In Bulgaria while I was listening to your podcast.
You know, I was totally in the rooms in these on my own in the hotel listening to your podcast going, right, okay, this is how your guests have done it. This is what to go through. Because until you've made a feature film, you honestly do not know what it's like.
No.
It's really hard to put into words. We can talk about it to a blue in the face. And even when you did, I still didn't believe it. I still did not believe it. So again, filmmakers out there who've not made one, you'll think the same. You go, oh, it's just talk. I'll be fine. No. You'll be dead. Your brain is fried. You have so much information you need to keep hold of.
But the thing is,
if you're in a studio.
No, that's the thing. Like you were making your first feature at a completely different level than I was making my first feature.
Very true, mate.
About $5,000 mine, yours,
yeah,
a little bit more. Studio and, you know, storyboard artists and backlots, and they're building stuff for you.
But here's what I've learned, Alex. There's no difference. But at the end of the day, it's just you and the actors, you, the camera and the actors. Technically, it doesn't matter how beautiful it is. It doesn't matter how amazing your shot is. If the acting's not right, if the story's not right, no one will care. That's why people love Meg, because it was you lot in a room doing it and the story was brilliant. This is what filmmakers need to know, is that it's all about the script. The script has to be the best it can be for the story you've got. The rest doesn't matter. You have to work brilliantly with your actors and get the performances you need so that people enjoy your film. You can shoot on an iPhone.
Absolutely.
You can shoot on your dad's old VHS cam recorder. It doesn't matter as long as the story's good enough.
I mean, you should shoot besides the VHS. I mean, let's just throw that out there. I mean, like, you don't need to. There's other options, sir. Go to Best Buy here in the States and then return it in 30 days. And return it in 30 days and you get a free camera. I mean, there's these things. I mean, I don't approve of that, but I've heard other filmmakers do things like that. And you were one of the few people ever to watch Ego and Desire on the big screen. You know, I had a short film festival run because I didn't do a lot of film festivals with it. But you saw it at the world premiere at Raindance.
I did. I was there at the Raindance Film Festival. We obviously promoted it on our podcast a lot. And a lot of the people who listened turned out. It's the first time I met a lot of these people as well. And they were there. And it's like, hey, so nice to meet you. Do you know what, as well, we're talking about the podcasting indie film world is, you all connect. And this is what I've loved about doing mine and you coming on. And everyone will message me and go, oh, I love Alex's stuff. It's so great. You're all connecting. But all the indie filmmakers I talk to and you talk to, we all kind of know each other. We're all in the world of just going out there and making our films. And what I've learned is that pretty much every single journey is different. Not one route is the same. Hey, yeah, at the end of the day, you need money and you shoot a film. Sure.
Amen.
But there's millions of different ways that that could happen and fall down and go up and down. And that just says it all. There's no secret. There's no like, oh, that's the button to press.
One thing I've learned, and I wasted a lot of time doing this when I was coming up, is I read every biography about filmmakers I could get my hands on. Yeah. I watched every documentary about how movies are made. And of course, I came up, and I think you and I are similar vintages. I think I might be a little bit older than you, but we came up around the time of the 90s, yes, where correct. The myth of Rodriguez, Tarantino, mm-hmm. Kevin Smith, yeah. Spike yes. Lee, mm-hmm. Soderbergh, Christian Singleton, that group of the 90s, Linkletter, mm-hmm. like all of that group, it was like every week there was a new appointed myth. And you're like, well, maybe if I go down the Kevin Smith route, maybe I'll get that way. Or maybe if I go down Mariachi's route, and before that, it was like, maybe I'll do what Spielberg did and I'll do that. And maybe I'll do what Lucas did, or maybe I'll do what Coppola did. At the end of the day, there is no, you could study all of them and you might be able to take a couple of ideas from each path, mm-hmm. but the yeah. path that comes, look at your path, dude. Look at your path.
Yeah.
There's no path crazy, like right? that. Look at my path. Like my path, I was like, oh yeah, I made my first feature because I was a podcaster. Like after 20 odd years of directing commercials, music videos and series and doing post on like 50 features and all the stuff I did, it was podcasting that gave me the courage to finally go, I'm going to make my first feature. Cause I had I don't know what it was mentally, dude. I don't know if this was with you, but with me, it was about, well, if it doesn't work, I could just go back to doing what I do. You know, and I was going to do it anyway, but like I felt comfortable. Yes. I felt safe because I had a community. Even back then, mm-hmm. it was 2017, so it was a smaller community than I have now. But it was still like, I'm just going to do this and see what happens. And what the hell?
And also because you're preaching to people, you know, you're talking to people about filmmaking.
Right.
And then, like I say, the difference between you before you'd made a feature and after with your podcast, do you know what? Suddenly it's like,
you could tell the difference. You could tell tell the difference before and after I shot that first feature, the tone. And then, well, the tone of my podcast, I'm sure is yours as well, it's changed. Like, you go back and listen to those first few episodes, first 15 to 20, I'm just. Well, first of all, they're horrible. I hate those first episodes. It's just
I know what you mean. Yeah, it's just don't listen to those. Early just ones.
They're, no they're brutal. But you could hear the angry, bitter filmmaker there a little bit more. I was a little bit more angry and bitter. That's why I always tell people: everybody here knows an angry and bitter filmmaker, and if you don't know an angry and bitter filmmaker, you are the angry and bitter filmmaker. And it's so true. So you could feel that bitterness a bit more. Then and the grizzled voice and all the stuff and the shrapnel, and that's still with me. But after you made that first feature, as small as that film was, it's like it's really quiet little kind of mumblecore style film that I made, which was completely, I've never made anything like that. I was always doing action movies. It was just like, I want to get this done. And and afterwards, I can't explain it to people. I don't know if you felt like this, because the thing that stopped me for so many years of making a movie is because I said, well, if it's my first feature, it's got to come out like Reservoir. Like it's got to come out like Mariachi. Like I got to come out guns a-blaring. And that was so much pressure to put on yourself as a first-time filmmaker. You can't do that. You can't do that. Would you agree?
I totally agree. I think people put way too much pressure on their first feature. And I say this a lot to people I mentor and stuff like that now from the London Film School and whoever else that I'm mentoring. Stop worrying about your first feature being this breakout hit. How you think of all the filmmakers out there in the world, how many of them are breakout filmmakers? You could probably name the ones we've just named. There isn't many more. So out of those 100,000 films that came out last year, how many of them are broken out? None. Had they gone on to make other films? Well, okay, maybe 50% of them. Great. Be that filmmaker. Go make a film and make another one. Don't put everything on your first film being this huge success, because you'll only fail by doing that, or you'll never make a film.
Well,
I got lucky.
I mean, you look at Nolan. His first film is The Following. Mm-hmm. Not a breakout hit. Not a breakout hit. You know, it wasn't a breakout hit. Then you look at Ridley Scott. Look at Ridley Scott, one of the most accomplished filmmakers, first-time filmmakers in history. He had directed what? 4,000 commercials at that point in his life. And he did The Shootist. And The Shootist, a beautiful film, not a breakout. Not a breakout hit.
No.
So, but that was the myth in the 90s that kind of – I feel that independent film became independent film in the 90s. And I think so many filmmakers still hold on to that idea of independent filmmaking that doesn't exist anymore. Like those guys – and I said this so many times on the show. Kevin Smith shows up today with Clerks. He'll never get seen. Robert Rodriguez shows up with Mariachi. Linkletter shows up with Slacker. The only one out of that crew that really might make some noise is Tarantino with Reservoir because it's just such a
Then he'd already written a big breakout hit. Do you see what I mean? He'd already done that first movie he wrote. You know,
well, he did True Romance. He wrote True Romance and Natural Born Killers. So he was already a screenwriter at that point. Yeah, a publisher or a professional screenwriter. So, but it's just you can't put that much pressure on you. And us as filmmakers, we put so much pressure and so much stress on it. And when I finally just said, screw it, I'm just going to make a film and I don't care how it – I mean, I don't care what happens with it. I'm just going to tell my story and go on. And my second film, Ego and Desire, was that in spades.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was brilliant. And I really enjoyed watching it at the, you know, the premiere there in London. It was so cool. But the fact that you made that in a, you know, at Sundance, who does that?
Nope.
Alex Ferrara does that. Actually does that. Hey, listeners, guess what I'm going to do? If you're not inspired by Alex, you're not inspired by anybody. Do you know what I mean?
Go out, I appreciate
that. You can go out and make a film. There you go. It premiered at Raindance Film Festival. Yeah, Alex Ferrari did that by just going, hey, I'm going to shoot a movie with actors I've not met.
With actors I haven't met, and we're going to shoot it in 4 days. For about $3,000 while I'm shooting interviews for my podcast. It was like a side hustle.
It was a side hustle. And you're in the movie as a podcaster, which is even better. I mean, the whole thing's just meta.
That's such a meta film I can't even explain to you. But obviously, with all your future films, you need to use a star wipe. Obviously, a star wipe
I've got to move forward to that level. Once I've got a star wipe in my film, I've made it. That's where I need to be. It might take me a while, a few more films yet, but when you see that star
wipe. That's an inside, you have to see the film, guys. It's an inside joke, star wipe. But if you, when the star wipe shows up, you'll just go,
There it is. I was waiting for the little, the actual star that they have, and then the star grows and goes out. I was looking forward to one of those.
We didn't have the budget for things like that, sir. We didn't have the time nor the budget for things like that. I want to talk about the vegan documentary that you're making. So what's the name of it? It's Food for Thought?
It's called Food for Thought, yeah. And it's on health. It's on the plant-based lifestyle we're having now, and it's on animal welfare. And because I have a voice in the filmmaking community and because I care and I'm a filmmaker, I was like, well, why aren't I making something that I'm passionate about? Because The Dare is a commercial type movie that has a message, but it's not,
it's not going to change the world. It's not going to change the world. It's entertainment.
No, there's bullying messages and all that stuff in there. But hey, I wanted to do something I was passionate about. Myself and Dan Richardson, fellow vegan, said, why aren't we making a movie about this and what we care about? And we said, let's do it. You know, he's a big sort of face in that kind of world anyway. And he's, Born Free ambassador. So we've got connections. And we were like, we've got cameras. We've got equipment. Let's just go shoot it. So we came up with this idea to say, why don't we get a load of people who aren't vegan to go vegan for 30 days? We'll document their whole life. And during that, we'll interview people who either care about this or feel that their cancer cured them or they got cured of cancer by going plant-based. You know, we wanted to talk to these type of people who, by going plant-based or having to care about animals, made a difference. And we care about this and we wanted to do something. And we asked you to be in the documentary as well, which you very kindly agreed to be interviewed.
Yes.
And and that's interesting. You were in the doc because obviously we started talking on the podcast and found out you were vegan as well. And we were like, you've got to be in the doc. We were worried about because we've traveled around the world. You know, we traveled to Croatia, LA and Sweden and obviously London and South Africa. We were like, how are we going to afford this. This is just us, and we want to do this properly and make this really good. So we did a crowdfunder. We raised a really nice amount of money, but we were very clever about how we did that. Mm-hmm. We specifically targeted, the riches are in the niches, as you always say, and we targeted the niches. We targeted vegan groups. We targeted animal welfare groups. We targeted health companies, and we literally did different techniques for every day, how we were targeting them, why they would invest, and then that would spread out into that market. And suddenly we'd have money flying in from all around the world, and we ended up raising 75K on that crowdfunder, which is ridiculous and insane. But that's because we were passionate about it, and our story came across that way, and we really worked our asses off. It was literally like making a feature film for a month.
Oh, no, it's brutal, isn't it? Crowdfunding is a brutal...
Crowdfunding is horrible. We don't want to do it again.
Me neither. It's rough. It's rough.
What that meant was that we could afford to hire in a camera team. We could afford to fly to these places, and we can afford to spend that on marketing and use a lot of that money to market the movie and self-distribute ourselves. And the only reason I wanted to self-distribute this movie was because of Alex's brilliant book, Rise of the Film Entrepreneur. And that is fact. Honestly.
Oh, I appreciate that.
About going... We could. Distributes are going to jump all over this. When we were in Cannes last year, not this year, obviously, the amount of distributes were like, we'll take this.
Oh, of course they will. They won't give you any money, but they'll take it.
Won't give any money. We knew that, but we went. But because this is the really weird thing about this, we'd rather this, and this is kind of not true, but we want more eyeballs on this because we want people to understand how the world is going to really implode on itself unless we all change and make a difference. So we want more eyeballs on that. So we also didn't want to self-distribute this ourselves if we didn't know what we were doing. And because of the book, we were like, we're going to self-distribute ourselves because we thought we can do this. Alex, I felt you gave us that power and passion that we could make the money from this. And I'm not mean, and that money can then go back into us making more docs about this world and about how we can not necessarily save the planet, but save people's lives who are mm-hmm. eating the wrong kind of foods, who are not being careful, who are ruining the environment and animals and treating them badly. And that we can do that. Why give it to a distributor who's going to run off with that money? And then we can't make more films from that. Hey, people might know of the doc, but we want to continue this as a business and keep going. And you inspired us to do that 100%.
I am humbled and I appreciate that. And I mean, obviously, because the book, obviously, I talk about the Vegan Chef movie. And
yeah,
all.
And I'd want to make that movie, by the way. So, if there's a screenwriter who wants to write that, I'll make it.
I think there's people out there listening who've read the book and they're just like, I'm afraid of doing that because Alex said it first. I'm like, I am giving free reign. It's a free idea. If someone out there can make the vegan romantic comedy that I've laid out the story pretty much. It's laid out in between episodes and in the book and all this stuff.
Yeah.
Go make it. Just let me know. I'll come on. I want you on the show. I want to, and I'll help you. I'll help you put out the business, the filmtrepreneur business around it. Yeah. Just please. So basically what I laid out in the book, a lot of examples are with the Vegan Chef movie, which are like, and you could do this because it's vegan, and you could do that because it's vegan. You basically just took that blueprint.
Totally. I was like, has he written this for me? This is Vegan Doc, and he's written this book all about how a Vegan Chef movie could happen. I'm like, well, we can follow all that. We can do this ourselves. And hey, it's going to be a ton of work. But interestingly, since making movies, I've now moved into helping other filmmakers get with the right distributors, and especially with all your wonderful Facebook group as well. There's so much amazing knowledge on there, and other filmmakers helping people. And luckily we got amazing distributors on the day. We got the Horror Collective, who are just absolutely wonderful, and I can't recommend them enough. And what they do is they spell everything out, and they give you a spreadsheet of where the money's been spent, how much money's come back in.
Stop it!
It's all there.
Stop it.
Yep.
You mean transparency with a distributor?
Yep.
Sacrilege, sir. Sacrilege. Did they get kicked out? Did they kicked out of the distributors guild by doing things like that?
Yeah. Well, interestingly, Shaked used to be at Epic, and now he's not. He's set up his own.
Shaked's
new company, the Horror Collective.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
I forgot the name. It was because he has Yeah. Okay. That's one of his branches of his new company.
Yeah, so he has entertainment.
So Shaked, everyone knowing Shaked's been on the show. Shaked's been on the show a couple times. He's a friend and he actually does care about filmmakers. And he's
there you go.
He's one of the good guys.
He's one of the good guys. So I highly recommend, if you've got a horror movie, go to him. They've been brilliant. So because of making movies and helping other filmmakers, we've taken another movie to the Horror Collective, which we are now acting as sort of
sales
producers reps. Sales, yes. But more producers reps than sales. But it's a better word, right? Mm-hmm.
Sure.
But I now understand that world, mainly, you know, from your book, but also from understanding that. And it's so important. So self-distribution, even though it's going to be very difficult, with the vegan documentary, Food for Thought, it makes so much sense for us to do that ourselves, especially with Dan's reach, being Born Free Ambassador and everything, and with my doing the podcast and my world out there.
Yeah, and the budget, and it's not an expensive – it's already been paid for essentially, so you're in the black right away.
Already, yeah.
Yeah, there's so much you could do with that. You know, I one day will make a vegan documentary, but I was just like, this makes all the sense in the world. Like it's – I just think the blueprint's laid out. I mean, there's so many of these vegan docs have just built out multi-million dollar businesses around their films.
Totally. Totally. We should give you a percentage, really, Alex, and maybe we can talk to us.
Just send cash, toilet paper, and ammo. That's all we need.
Is ammo.
Ammo, because we're American. Obviously, we're American, so we need ammo, toilet paper, and that's fine. And cash if you need. That's fine.
Cash just is what you need.
Huh? Straight.
Yeah.
No wiring. Just straight. Actually, pounds. Yeah. If you could send pounds over, that'd even be better.
I'll fax them across to you.
That'd be great.
By VHS on its way to you.
My friend, we could keep talking for at least another 2 hours. This is what happens when two podcasters get together.
Totally. Yeah.
I'm gonna ask you now a few questions I ask all of my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
Great question. I love this question. I say, educate yourself on everything you can about filmmaking. Don't go into this blind. Find a project that you love. Understand that market. So if it's a skateboarding movie or a BMX movie, perfect, because it's a niche movie. Target that audience with it. Understand what they like and don't like. Get a BMX sponsor on board. Whatever it is, that's the way to make a movie as a first-time filmmaker, because now you've got a chance of your movie breaking out. Not many films get made about gymnastics. Make one about that. You know, whatever it is, BMXing. I think that to me is really important. And I suppose it's what I talked about earlier, is don't worry about it not being a huge success. Don't worry about it not being on Netflix and all your friends going, when can I see it on Netflix? Don't worry about that. It's all about your journey as a filmmaker. And I tell you what, if you want to be that filmmaker, the director, the screenwriter, the producer, it's a long career. If your film makes massive straight away, you might never recover from that. It's too big. Who knows? I mean, yeah, hey, we all want that. But it's a long journey. Don't forget that. And find a project that's right for you. Find a screenwriter that you love. And I tell you what, you only need to search, put a little email out, a Facebook out. I'm looking for a screenwriter. Who's got an idea?
Oh, no, don't do that. Oh, no. That's, don't go, hey, I'm looking for a screenwriter. No. Don't do that, guys. Please. That's a recipe for disaster. Do some research. There's some good websites, Blacklist, Slated, Stage 32, where you can network and connect with other screenwriters and other projects that you might be able to work with. But definitely do not go on Facebook and go, hey, anybody want to make a movie? Yeah, don't do that.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, what I mean by that is find the right screenwriter for your project, wherever that is. Find
exactly.
That. And then, find the team. Again, the same. Yeah. You speak to people. Go to events. There'll be people, then there's another filmmaker, you go, hey, I saw you. Can I see your short? And if the short's brilliant, ask him who the DP was and work with them. There's so many ways you can do it. But that, for me, that's really vital, is know what film you want to make and then really target how you can really make a business from that and a great film from it.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Sign contracts. early on, I didn't do this at all. And it was a huge mistake. Like I say, projects got taken away from me. Things happened. If I'd signed a contract with these people, it wouldn't have happened. And even if that's on a napkin, and I'm sure you're going to jump down the throat and say, no, don't do that. But whatever it is. And no, I'm joking. But I feel it's really important that when you're working with people, things can go wrong. When you're starting out, people do talk the game. So if you've got something signed, at least then you're not going to get burnt. And within that, don't be afraid to walk away. You might have worked on it for so long, but hey, if it's not working, they're not the right people. Walk away, because it's too short to be hurt, to be messed around. Go do something else. Have more than one project. That took me the longest to learn. I spent 8 years on one project. Waste of time. Yeah.
Yep. Yes. Now, what was the biggest fear you had to overcome to make your first film?
I think it was my own fear of not being good enough. I think it was my fear of not understanding my actual ability and my own courage, and overcoming that. And like I say, not being scared. Okay, you were the actor. Okay, you wrote stuff. Okay, you put stuff on in theatre. But it was that fear of thinking you're not good enough. But I tell you what, if you've got a vision and you've got an understanding of how you want it to be set out, even if you don't know technicalities of a camera or you've not worked with actors before, if you've got a vision and you're passionate, you'll be great. You'll be fine. And that to me that was my fear. And I had to overcome that. You know, once you're on a studio movie, you suddenly need to overcome that very quickly.
And three of your favorite films of all time.
Okay. Magnolia. Love it. Mm-hmm. I probably should rewatch it. Terminator 2,
mm-hmm.
and Slumdog Millionaire.
Yeah, such a great film. I love that film.
Such a great film. And plus, they're all very different genres, I notice. I do love romantic comedy. I'm a sucker for that. I'll be making some soon.
Yeah, you make a vegan chef romantic comedy any day now.
Well, there we go. We just need someone to write it.
And where can people...
I'll put that out on Facebook.
yes, absolutely. And where can people find you, Giles?
You can find me on Twitter. Is mainly where I do a lot of my social media stuff. It's at Giles Alderson on Twitter. That's mainly where I am. Website is GilesAlderson.com. But yeah, my films, the films that are out, the Dare and, the Arthur movie, Arthur and Merlin, which is cool. And the podcast, if you fancy it, is the Filmmakers Podcast, which is on Twitter at Filmmakers Pod.
Yes, I recommend this podcast. It's a fantastic podcast. And it's a great addition to the Indie Film Hustle podcast. Because if you get tired of listening to my voice all the time, it's nice.
Say, the episodes with Alex, you could listen to those. But hey, you've
No. That's all they need. It's to listen to me here and then go listen to me talk more over there. It's enough. Giles, man, thank you so much for being on the show, brother. I appreciate it. And congrats on all your success and for everything you're doing for the film community. I appreciate you, brother.
Alex, thank you. And honestly, same goes to you. You're an absolute inspiration and a joy, and you're a wonderful guy as well. So well done. Everyone, give it up to Alex. Well done, buddy. Thank you.
I want to thank Giles for coming on the show and dropping those knowledge bombs. Thank you for a hell of a tale, Giles. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/423. And if you haven't checked out his podcast, the Filmmakers Podcast, I highly recommend it. Now, guys, next week I will be doing a couple more podcasts. I know Christmas falls on I think Thursday or Friday or both, you know, Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. So I will be still releasing a couple of episodes next week. Look for them somewhere in the week. I don't know when I'm releasing them, but they will still be coming out. So keep an eye out for that. Thank you guys so much for listening. I want to wish everybody a Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy Kwanzaa, Happy Holidays. And I hope you all stay safe and your families stay safe in this crazy, crazy upside down world and this crazy year that has been 2020. I cannot wait for it to be over and hopefully on to better, better things in 2021. I will talk to you soon, as always. Keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.